Hello, my name is Lynn Tinney, and I'm a proud member of the board for the Massachusetts Conference for Women. A few shop housekeeping items. If you have a cell phone, if you can please put that on silent. We know we have a few more people that will be coming in, so allow for people to sit down. There's plenty of seats still. I wanted to tell you when Jess Black, who arranges many of our speakers, asked me to MC this session. Of course, I'm just giddy to do anything, right? I'm like the girl in the front of the classroom doing the ooh, ooh, ooh. I picked up the book. It's a good, hefty book. You'll learn more about it. There is a book signing at 12:30, so you do not want to miss that. But I am a voracious reader. If I have a confession to make, I'm a bit of a book snob. I really am a book snob. I have a very high bar. I look for well-written material. I look to be caught and captured through the whole, however many pages there are. I got this book, in the mail, like a day or two after I knew I was emceeing, and I thought, oh, I have 260 pages of homework. Great. And I have like three books I'm really into right now, so I kind of was doing a little teeth grinding that moment. But being the good little doobie that I am, I grabbed my glass of wine, my favorite little blanket, snuggled in, watched my husband watch something horribly sophomoric on TV, and I did not get up for 120 pages. The Chardonnay was the only thing that made me move. It is empowering, well-written. You will love this book, and that is coming from a book snob. So. Let me tell you about the speaker for this session today. You've picked a good one, first of all. All progress is born of new ideas. They let us reimagine who we are. Today's speaker finds her inspiration in a vision of a world where everyone's ideas count and have a shot. She seeks inspiration in the stories of everyday people doing extraordinary things. This is only achievable when each of us matters. And everyone counts. Through her concept of onlyness, she offers a powerful roadmap for anyone who has an idea for making a difference but lacks the know-how and the credentials to be heard. All of us have been there with this one day, multiple times. So sit in those shoes. Be inspired by a woman whose own ideas have ruptured the status quo. That's capital R. Ladies and gentlemen, Niloufer Merchant.
That was just lovely, Lynn. Thank you so much. Good morning. I was looking at the slides a minute ago, and we were having a few little technical problems getting up, and I thought I would much rather actually just chat and have a conversation with you about the idea and what I think it means for us as a generation of people who can change the world. So first, the idea. The word onlyness does not yet have a place in the English dictionary, but it should. Because at its simplest, it says that everyone, quite possibly anyone and everyone, can count. It comes from two things. Each of us stands in a spot in the world only you stand in. A function of your history and experience, as well as your visions and hopes. It's how we've always, each of us, created value. The problem is that onlys sometimes don't count. But if you can find the other people with whom you can scale in connectedness, you now can. Modern day example, we're living in the news today, Time made it the person of the year, is the Me Too campaign. How many of us have experienced sexual harassment? Data says it's about 90% of the workforce. Sad, right? We weren't not saying our truth when it happened. We just weren't being heard. And now that we can actually claim our own truth and connect with the other people who can actually make that idea more powerful, suddenly, or so it seems, it has momentum, right? So that's the opportunity that's actually happening. A bunch of our onlys whose voices have been quieted and negated and ruled out simply because of the packaging that the idea came in finally has a shot. I coined this term, and I'm not a word coiner, back in 2011, 2012, to point to how the economy was going to change. I was looking at examples in an industry like tech and showing how platforms were actually doing something quite different. So let me share that, and then I'll share why I'm the person who was noticing it. So Apple, I worked at Apple early on in my career. In fact, I have a funny experience of facing Steve Jobs when he came back to the company. So he had been gone on the exodus, and as he returns, I had been working there and actually building a program that had gone from $2 million to $180 million in one of the few profitable, growing parts of the business. And Steve Jobs walks into the room, and this is, I'm not trying to use a bad swear word at this moment, but these are his exact words. The title behind me says channel manager. I had been running this really successful program, so my business unit had put me up to go present in front of him with the hope, of course, that our business unit would continue existing after this presentation. And Steve Jobs walks in the room with his logo t-shirt, and this is before he had his black uniform outfit down, and flip-flops, by the way, that were 20 years old. Somebody should have told him that they need to be thrown out every few years. Really sketchy. And jeans, and he sits down, he puts his feet on the table. And here I am with my little navy Ann Taylor suit, trying to look so presentable at 20-something. And again, my title behind me says something like channel manager. And so these are the first words that Steve Jobs says to me. Fuck the channel. We don't need the fucking channel. And I literally looked over at my colleagues who were much older and more experienced than I was. And I had this look like, so do I end the presentation now? And they were sort of like, you know, they kind of did the kind of shrug back, like, we have no idea. And so I ended up going through the entire presentation, pitching the thing, and walking out the door, going back to my desk and writing to someone who had just offered me an opportunity to join a startup and saying, yes, I would very much like to talk to you about that opportunity. But I digress. So I was at Apple when there were things that were called back then mobile devices. And as a company, you would back then have chosen one or two or three apps that might go on deck. Again, I'm dating myself, right? 10 years ago, that's exactly what happened. Companies were going through and choosing, and companies were investing $1 million to $2 million in development, probably another $1 million or $2 million in sales and development, in order to even have a shot at being able to have picked by a big company. And then Apple ended up deciding, well, why are we the ones gatewaying the idea marketplace? Why not actually figure out how to be a marketplace of ideas? So in the form of apps, they actually figured out how to lower that cost of development from $1 million to $2 million to $10,000. Today it's $500, right? Google came along and helped move it along. So all these companies that were literally like letting like 9 ideas in, Nokia, Samsung, etc., now had this opportunity to let in hundreds of thousands of ideas, but all those ideas now had a shot because there was a platform and mechanism by which those ideas could actually find a marketplace. And I squinted at that pattern that was going on in the industry and the tech cycle and saying, well, if that can happen there, could this actually allow a bunch of us with our unusual ideas to actually be able to be seen? And so I coined that onlyness. But in this marketplace of platforms, you might be able to change things. So I was looking at it purely from a business standpoint, and then I started sitting there thinking, well, could this change power? Could it change people of color and women and young people, people who are traditionally underseen and underserved, to participate in an economy? And I honestly didn't know. It was just a hypothesis. So I started studying that. And that's what ultimately led to this body of work, which, by the way, Lynn, that was such a lovely compliment that you read it. I think everyone approaches business books the same way, with this sort of like, it's probably going to suck. I certainly do, and I get asked to read a lot of them now. People, when they had a chance to, I was asking like early friends and colleagues to read the first couple stories I had found, and the first couple examples that I was decoding to say, here's how this might work. And a girlfriend who happened to work at CNN and is an expert on the topic of agency, which is what this book is, I had asked her to read it. And so she read about 6 stories, which were done, and she said, okay, now I know the color of their underwear, but I don't know your underwear. And now remember, I'm a business person, economist by training, business person. No one needs to know the color of my underwear, I'm thinking, right? Who wants to be that person? And so I was actually like, no, I'm not in the book. Not in the book. And she's like, no, I'm not following these incredibly revealing stories about how people claim their own power, find their community, and act out that truth without also knowing that you've been on this journey. And so I'll tell you the story that's in the book, the very opening story, because it really tells you why I'm the one who is noticing this pattern, why I'm that thinker that doesn't look like the white male thinkers of the world who is spotting that this could be the breakthrough. When I was 18 years old, I had come home from community college, which is what I was doing at the time, and found my house full of aunties and a few uncles, but mostly aunties, making a huge feast of biryani, because that day they had finally figured out who I was going to marry. And it had been, you know, they call it arranged marriage because, well, it's arranged. And that was that day. And I had grown up in America since I was 4 and a half, born in Bombay, raised in California, very much a product of both cultures. So understanding that my mother needed and wanted me to take care of her, and had a responsibility and obligation there, but also the kid who showed up in journalism class and was a member of the FBLA. Anybody ever been a member of the FBLA? This is like a very interesting, okay, do you want to know what it is, for those of you that don't know? Future Business Leaders of America. I also took typewriting and accounting classes, like that's the kid I was, right, in school. And so my mother has, you know, so living in these two worlds, I show up and I ask my uncle, who was negotiating on our behalf because my father was out of the picture, hey, did you ask that guy if I could get an education? And he says, no. And I thought for a second, maybe he had forgotten that I'd asked him to ask that. So I asked another question, and he goes, your mother will not allow this conversation to happen. You can wait till after you're married and then ask him then. In arranged marriages, for those of you that don't know, you typically don't meet one another before the marriage. You certainly don't have standing until you're in the marriage. And for those of you that have ever been young in your career, you know it takes a while to establish standing. So it would take at least a year or 2 years for me to even be able to approach that conversation. And all my friends had already gone off to college, and I had not been able to, and I had always wanted to do that. And so I was going to community college, sort of biding my time. Unbeknownst to my mother, I had already applied to Berkeley and gotten in, UC Berkeley, and I'd already filed for a one-year extension, which was coming up. And so I really wanted this question to be asked and answered sooner rather than later. I'm a pretty polite person most of the time, so I waited until all the aunties left the house, and then I did my theatrical move. It was my last desperate attempt to get what it was I wanted out of my life. And Indian culture, often you come home with sort of cardboard boxes of groceries with no cover or anything on it, and I just literally grabbed the local box that I found in the, you know, in the house, and I, in front of my mother, said, I am the product. You cannot do this deal without me. That's the FBLA side of me talking. And I literally took $5, and now this is talking about priorities, $5, one outfit, no toothbrush, because I'm not expecting this to last long. I'm expecting this to be like, if I make it around the block, maybe she's going to change her mind, right? Because, like, she can't do this without me. I'm just thinking logic would suggest, ask the question, and of course I'm going to, if the answer is no, I'll live with that. But the answer is probably going to be yes. So all I just want you, I just want to circle the block with this box. So I do the $5, one outfit, no toothbrush, walk out the door, have no idea where I'm going. Do you want to know where I ended up? You do, don't you? A donut shop. As one does when one is stressed, carbohydrates are the answer to everything. So one apple fritter, one donut hole later, I call home. Actually, I call my sister because I really don't want to call home. And I call my older sister, who's since gone on and been, in fact, in an arranged marriage, and I say, so what's up? Like, has she caved? She's like, well, Mom says she's going to kill herself if you don't come home. I turn to my sister, who, by the way, you know, she's like, we've grown up, we really know each other pretty well, and I go, she's not really going to kill herself, right? And she goes, I don't know, she's pretty upset. And so I go, well, then you better get yourself over there, because, you know, then at least she won't kill herself. And then maybe talk to her about the fact that this is one question she can ask on my behalf. Just agree and I'll come home. So my sister, I talked to her another couple hours later. I have to then go figure out, okay, where else can I go kill time? I call her a couple hours later and she's like, yeah, she's not caving. So I end up finding a couch to sleep on and the next place, a place to brush my teeth. And then I call home again. That answer hadn't changed. The answer didn't change for 30 years. So on that day, I was homeless, penniless, family disowned. You see, in that architecture, what was my value? As a girl, as an Indian Islamic girl, my job, my value, was to marry well. Were they noticing the person, the individual, and their history and experience and wishes and wants? They were only seeing the grouping, the outside skeleton of the person, not the interior truth of what that person wanted or wished in the world. So, of course, I ended up walking down to the financial aid office and saying, hey, can I borrow some money? Which I've never taken a loan out before, but can I borrow some money? And that guy says, of course. And he hands me $500 out of discretionary money, makes me sign a piece of paper, and then he walks me around campus and says, she wants an education. Can we get her a job on campus so she can pursue her education? And so I got an accounting job so that on Friday afternoons I did the accounting for the History Museum. I got an ushering job so on Saturday nights I could watch speakers come through the community, but I could earn $15 an hour for ushering. I could code, so I ended up doing a coding program which could be done between school hours, and so I had four jobs that allowed me to live largely on campus, allowed me to find a room to rent, allowed me to pay back that debt so I could go to school. It took me 12 years, but I did it. Why? Why did all those people help me? What did they see? They saw that they shared something in common with me, right? They too believed in education regardless of gender, regardless of class, regardless of age. And so they were as committed to my purpose being manifest in the world as I was. So I found a new family and a way to belong. But I had to leave the group of people who didn't believe in me, who didn't actually see me as the person I was. So I then go on to a career at Apple, which I shared with you one of the stories. But one of the first stories, I showed up as an admin. And I was, again, going to school at night and an admin during the day. And at one point, they said, hey, we're having a strategy meeting, and everyone can come, and we're going to solve this problem. And I, being the doobie, the totally studious person, actually do research and make notes and show up with questions, all excited in the meeting. And it took a minute, two, three, to realize no one was making eye contact with me. That in that room, what they valued was the MBA types. And then I would notice in other rooms, sometimes they valued the marketing people, sometimes they valued the salespeople, sometimes they only valued the CEO, sometimes they only, you see where I'm going. All of us have been in rooms where depending on the group that we belong to, the outside shell of that categorization, we were negated. This is, by the way, not a problem tied to gender, although it certainly feels very gendered when we're living it. It is a problem tied to power. Who has status in that room? Who gets to count? So as I was living my life and doing strategy work, I noticed that in each room, we often left out the ideas that counted. It could be the admin who took a customer call and knew the customer pain. It could be all the different ways in which we limit innovation simply because of the shell of the person. And so it occurred to me when I started seeing this pattern across the tech industry that platforms were allowing ideas to scale, what if in connectedness we could each scale? So can I tell you a couple things I've learned? Yeah? Nearly 50 years old next month, so this is what I've learned so far. The first step to claiming your power is to claim your own truth. That is not to deny that thing that has happened to you that you don't like. So most of us, when we try to claim our own truth, here's the part we like. The part where we're educated, the part where we're confident, the part that we're successful, right? We like the light part of the story. We don't necessarily like the dark parts of the story. Things maybe that have happened to us, or mistakes we've made, or moments where we have not been our best self, but certainly have taught us something. We usually try to hide those things. You know, for a long time, I used to actually hide the fact that I went to community college, because most of the people that I worked with had a degree first thing out of college. Like, they had that path. They were almost always the people who had gone to college right after high school and then gone to an MBA degree a couple years after that, and so had accelerated their career through education, and so quite often were highly credentialed. And so I, as an outside party, would often go like, well, yeah, I'm not telling that part of the story. I recently had this moment where I was talking to a banking executive, a pretty senior woman, and she had a really profoundly good idea about how to serve the marketplace, because she actually understood that the lowest end of the marketplace doesn't use traditional banks. They use these sort of cash-in, check-cashing kind of places. Those places gouge customers to 5 to 10% of a check. The people who have the least amount of money to give away get gouged because that's the only way they can bank, because they don't have a bank balance. And she had an idea of how to solve the problem and serve that constituency. She was at, a very, very notable bank. And so she was telling me this idea that really was born of her truth, and she was telling me why she cared, because she'd grown up poor and had watched her mom have to deal with these people. And she wanted to be able to serve that space. And I said, wow, that's so exciting. Think about the lives you could change. And I said, how will you make that happen at your company? What will be the next step? Because again, I'm an innovation strategist person, right? So I'm like, okay, who are you going to go talk to, and what's it going to take, and all this. And she figured out how to drop the economics so that it would go from 5% of cost to about 0.5%. So really, really changing the economics of the person, but still allowing enough viability for the bank, which was a pretty profound thing that she had been able to kind of put together. And she goes, oh, well, I'm not going to tell anyone. I was like, why would you not tell anyone? Like, it made no sense to me for a second. And then I was like, oh, let me ask the next question. Why won't you tell anyone? And she said, well, look over there and notice that guy has an Hermes tie. That's a $400 tie. And notice that person over there is carrying an Yves Saint Laurent bag. That's a $2,000 bag. These people grew up with wealth. I did not. I've never told them that I did not. The way I belong to this bank and with this group of peers is to hide myself. Anybody have that experience? So one of the pieces of research I found super interesting was done by a woman named Christy Smith at Deloitte. She said that 61% of us cover at work. Covering being defined as that way in which we actually hide our own story in order to fit in to the organization as the current culture exists. 61%. As I clicked on that number, I expected the data to be women and people of color and young people, the traditionally underserved and underseen. And it turns out this problem is endemic across, this is why I say it, this is not a gender problem, this is a power problem, across genders, because nearly half of the straight white men reported to covering as well. And the click down of those stories were equally revealing. It was a guy who said he wore glasses in order to look older because his colleagues didn't take him seriously. It was the guy who didn't actually say he wanted to stay home with his kids because he was afraid his colleagues would think that he wouldn't care about work. It was all the ways in which we kind of tell the story other people supposedly want to see. In this, by the way, mirage of whatever normal is, normal because it has to be in air quotes on that case, what is normal? Normal is each of us. And yet we've been told that normal is to fit into a paradigm that represents 31% of the population, because the normal right now, the dominant narrative that is inside most of our organizations, is defined by white men. That percentage in America is 31% of the population. 31% of the population dominant narrative, by the way, even smaller than that if you actually think about how many of those are alpha males, because that's the culture that most cultures are modeled after. Because that guy who wants to take care of his kids, he's still a guy, he's still a white male, but he actually has, actually wants to not fit into this alpha male prototype. He wants to be himself. So we don't find our way to belong because we're fitting in. And in Brené Brown's words, to fit in that way is to fit into a half-life, right? When we're fitting in to belong, we're not actually being seen for ourselves. We're not even seeing ourselves. We're doing this thing to our own deception, our own truth, to say, gosh, how do I figure out how to be something that someone else wants, which is, by the way, a mirage, and an archetype that no one actually fits in. So that first step is to claim. The part about that that's hard, that I didn't realize until I was doing this research, is we can't claim it alone. In fact, I had to go back to research I had done. I had read Rosabeth Moss Kanter back in the 70s. Rosabeth Moss Kanter is one of the greatest change agent writers, Harvard professor, understands that world, and she had pointed out that if we're less than 15% of a group, so if you're the only woman in a corporate board of mostly white men, if you're sub 30 in a group full of mostly 50, if you're the entrepreneurial type in a world full of corporate drones, anytime you represent 15% or less of that majority narrative group, you almost always conform to that group. It's almost like an act of God if you don't. But the number changes around 30%, and at 50%, everyone's weird comes out. Because everyone's equally weird. Everyone's got their own point of view, their own perspective. And so that's the tipping point. Bless you. And now I just distracted myself. What was I saying? No. To claim oneself. No, it's good, right? We're in a group. Why should we pretend we're not in a group? Why should we, like, you could watch me on a video if you, you know, but to be in a group is to be in a group, right? So I said, claiming oneself is hard. What makes it easy? What makes it easy? I just finished kind of giving you a clue as to the numbers. What makes it easy? Anybody want to help me? 30%? Connection. That's it. So as you find the people who care about the same thing as you, because you have suddenly raised your hand and said, this is what I care about. Imagine if that banking executive said, I care to serve this group. She might have found the other people who cared about the same thing. As long as she was quiet, she was never going to be able to seek out those others. As soon as you find those people in connectedness, you can now actually have purpose. And then you can run that ball down the field. First step is to claim. Second is to connect. And the third is to channel action. The action part becomes pretty obvious. It's that connection part that's so hard. Because how do we learn to find each other? How do we learn to count on each other? How do we learn to trust each other? Because until we can actually have trust amongst us, we actually don't have the ability to take the same risks. So just as a simple example, how many of you have been at like a brunch or something and you shared some crazy wild idea you had, and then that group turned to you and said, I can totally see you doing that. They might even say, I have an idea of who you could talk to, or I'd love to support that. And then how many of us have actually been at a table where that same group, you had that crazy wild idea in Steve Martin language, and the group was like, How much are you going to go run with that idea? I mean, you might, right? But being, until you find that tribe of people, we use the word, by the way, community and tribe so often today, and yet we aren't actually using it well. And I say this because, what's a good example? Oh, Facebook. Facebook uses the word community all the time. When actually, by the way, what they're describing is a group of people aggregated in one common place so they can monetize your eyeballs while completely flushing the democracy, right? They don't care about community in the long term because they are literally willing to sacrifice their entire country's legal system for how you elect a president because they would like to monetize your outrage. That is not community. I don't know what definition that is, but that is not community. That is a bunch of individuals gathered together. Can I tell you what community looks like? Can you do it with me? So if you're a community right now, what would you do if you were a community? Boston, Massachusetts women, you're all here. Let's do this together. Let's just do this as a live exercise. I'm going to say be a community. Start building a community. Actually, that's the request. Start building a community right now. I'll give you a minute. Let's come back. Go. All right. This is actually the worst part of doing an exercise. I recognize that I'm doing probably the worst thing I could possibly do because actually this is the beautiful part of a conference like this is to actually get a chance to meet and get to know people. And I apologize for doing it so artificially in the sense that I have to then pull it back to re-engage this way. And yet I want to ask you, what even in that short window of time, how did you start building a community? You communicated. I saw you actually move over and make this. So what? Can share? And actually, do I have a mic I can hand you? I don't know if I do. What, okay, jump it out, and I'll.
I was a solo community member. I had to latch on to another community.
Yeah. So here she was alone, sitting quite separate, like a couple chairs apart, and I watched her kind of inch over and find another group to join. It was really kind of lovely to see. How'd that feel?
Good.
Did you feel welcomed?
Yes.
Yeah. What else did you guys do? Anyone? Yes?
Listened.
So important, right? It's not just about what we say, it's about how we listen. What else?
I made a connection.
Made a connection. What was the connection based on?
First industry, so
we actually worked on the same industry. Any other connection level?
Community,
so history, right? So from sort of location. Yes? So connection based on degrees and sort of the technical. Did anyone ask you about your knitting? Yeah, it's beautiful. I was watching you work on it while I was talking. So the reason I ask is here's an interest, right? Here's a passion of yours. You're displaying it pretty visibly. That's why I asked, did anybody ask you about the knitting? Because it's right there and beautiful turquoise color so everyone could see it. Okay, so we did where we're from, whether or not we went to the same schools, where we've grown up from, and then technical background in life sciences. What else? Curiosity. That's beautiful. That's a really beautiful way of connecting. Way in the back.
I talked
about
what I value.
Ah. Right. Talking about family can be a huge point of connection, right? Because almost all of us then also feel that same kinship of my family is really deeply important to me. Any other points of connection? Being pink? Yes. Oh, sorry. Next. Okay, and so what was it? Can I ask? And now I'm like all nervous.
We're a big group. We didn't get all the way around, but it's very much that we all are kind of individual contributors in our own completely different realms. We've got some of the worship grand songs, we've got a great instructor back there, but we're definitely more individual contributors, and so we want to come in and see what you had to say about being the only
So the individual contributor part was the hook. Interesting. Interesting. So far, yeah, that's really fascinating. And that's great because it's contextual, right? That connection is based contextually. Anyone else? And yes, and I want to come back to this. Thank you.
No worries. We talked about shared experiences. So since we're all here today, we talked about the keynote speaker this morning.
Viola.
Woo. And our honest feelings about that. And I feel like having a shared experience for us, even though we just met each other, helped to build that connection.
Who was most opinionated?
I think we all the same opinion. Like, it was kind of gushing a little bit.
Yeah, what's not to love? Yeah, what's not to love? She's amazing, right? She really tells you that story about how to stand your own truth. It's beautiful context for the day. Anybody else have anything else to add that's incrementally different? Yes?
Our first talk, we were professional women. We went right into how do we start to, after you've reached your pinnacle, it's so what, now what? And you want to push yourself to start doing, you get up to the top and you go, I sacrifice food, meals with my family to get to this. You know, I can be more and be better. So I came here, I think we all came here. How do we generate that idea? How do we connect with other people with great ideas so we can be at that crunch that person says, oh my gosh, that's great, I can see you doing that. We want to find other people who can help support us to do that. So my question at the podium would be, can you tell me the list.com or whatever that I can start to meet other people to help push ideas ahead instead of sitting in front?
Your answer, and I'm paraphrasing for the group, I'm not going to do it justice nearly as passionately as you just did, but for the purpose of getting it for everyone, you started talking about what gives you meaning and how do you, at this point in your career, start to serve other people and connect with other people so you can do bigger and better things. Is that fair? Good. So identity is what you were all talking about when we're talking about these things. Identity is a fluid thing. I want to just kind of expand on that for a second, and that's what that exercise was about us thinking about how do we make connections. Identity can be about the place we were born, the school we've gone to, the technical training we've received. It can be about our socioeconomic status. It can be about our gender. All those things are in the language, actually, Andrew Solomon gave me, who's a New Yorker writer, our vertical identity. Those are largely things we're born into, with the one sort of caveat that education can be a choice, but quite often is determined by our parents. Things we're born into, place of birth, our socioeconomic status, the language we speak, our gender, right? Okay. He gave us a lovely other way of thinking of identity, which is horizontal identity. What is it that gives my life purpose? What is it that matters to me that might matter to other people? And I love the combination of vertical and horizontal as a way of thinking about identity, right? Because we are born into certain things, but then we make choices. So the way I kind of like to think about it is, this is where the story starts, and this is how the story goes. The more we can understand that form of identity that is driven from choice, we can also understand how to find the other people who care about the same thing. As we also notice that horizontal identity question, we can actually be that person who listens well and sees the other person for what they are. One of the things about onlyness that I think is challenging for most people, so if I can actually do this exercise with you if you want, so you guys will give me feedback what you want. Quite often when people say, if I say, what's your onlyness? They will literally have this panicked look come across their face and be like, oh my God, no, don't ask me that question. And the reason I think most people freak out, and I mean that in the nicest possible way, is because they think there is one thing, and only one thing, and if they don't get it right, oh my God, they failed somehow. And they don't want to do that. And I want to just point out that we grow and change all the time. We are multifaceted in who we are. Just because the world chooses to simplify us doesn't mean we're simple. We are multidimensional. And so the question is, at this moment in time, given this context, who am I to you? Who do I want to be to you? What is my meaning in this context, right? And so when I'm at home, my full identity is not tied to the fact that I want to make people more powerful in the world, so that innovation happens from anywhere and everywhere. It's often tied to my kid's puking and I want to be really good at taking care of him. right? So it changes slight focus. It doesn't mean that I leave behind the other side of my dreams and aspirations about the world. It just means sometimes it's tailored. But one way that people can help one another is to think about onlyness as that light bulb that's over your head. It's you all lit up from the inside. And when you walk in the room changes. You see the world through that lens. So because I really care about power dynamics and have ever since I was young based on my earlier life experience, I notice power dynamics in every room, and I also change the power dynamics of every room. And so the only way I actually know what the room is with or without me is if someone says, Nilofer, you know what you really care about? You know what you're really good at? People can spy each other's light bulb because, by the way, they're in the room before the person walked in and they're in the room when the person leaves, so they can spot it easier. Which is not to say to ask someone, what should I do? But to say, what do you see about me? So as we think about identity, we can actually be that person who can actually hold that space for other people, right? And the light bulb metaphor, by the way, light bulb metaphor, we are always lit up. The more strongly we're lit up, the more that light bulb shines. And of course, it can dim based on context. People will say, no, you're that light's not allowed in here. It's also how we plug into the world. The onlyness is that purpose which connects you to the world. So if you care about homelessness, if you care about education, we just had this conversation, right? That's the way in which you can find the other people who care about you. So and we're about 12 minutes left to go. So we could do general Q&A. We could do some structured thoughts about how to take this home. What do you want to do? All at once now. Okay. Anyone struggling with claiming onlyness? Or have I explained that well? And who has a question about how to claim one's onlyness? Everyone's completely got it, and you're going to go out there and describe your onlyness in the future? No. Anybody want to raise their hand and ask the question? Could you go to the mic? Because that way I don't have to spend time repeating, and people can hear your beautiful magnificence.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is surrounding embracing your onlyness as it relates to stigma. For example, addiction issues, overcoming addiction issues, homelessness, overcoming a domestic abuse situation, situations like that.
So is there a specific that you want to ask for yourself?
I suppose all of them, but... mostly addiction issues, as that's still pretty surrounded in stigma these days.
Mm. Mental health too, right? So a friend of mine asked me this recently, and he, it turns out, had been a cocaine addict in his career and had spent about 5 years while he was writing, by the way, for the Financial Times, coked up. And he shared this with me privately and said he doesn't want anybody to know. And I said, well, why wouldn't you want anyone to know? And he's like, duh, like, come on. And I said, actually, try it. Try it in some venue where you actually tell people that's who you are and how it informs your story. Because that's actually the more relevant part, right? There is a way in which it informs our story and the work we do. Connect that dot and see how it sounds. And we were lucky enough to know some people that were hosting a really nice private retreat, like a speaker's kind of venue. But it was private enough where it wasn't videotaped, it wasn't meant for outside production, it was really just that inner group of people. And we talked it through, and I helped him a little with his presentation and stuff just to be a sounding board for him. And he went and shared this talk at this conference called the Do Lectures, which is based out of Wales, England. And he said, and he shared it with me, he said people came up to him and hugged him and supported him and started talking to him in a much more genuine way than he'd ever had before. And he said, was it me or was it them? And I'm like, well, isn't that both true? It changes you and how you even assert your own validity in the world instead of being shameful, because then suddenly you're stronger for knowing and connecting that dot to say, here's how I serve other people. I understand what it is to be in so much pain in a career that I will literally take drugs to hide that pain for myself. So now when he does career coaching, which is one of his things that he does, and working with brands to manifest their stories, he says, I understand that until you go through the pain and acknowledge the pain, you will never get to the other side. And that's how I actually help clients to acknowledge their own pain. And I was like, wow, that's pretty powerful. As a brand person, I want somebody to know to acknowledge my pain. So figuring out that connection could probably be the way in which you claim. Help?
Yeah,
That was a great question, by the way. Thank you. Should we move on to the next one? Oh, you. Yes. Yes, please. Thank you. And I would have forgotten, so thank you for holding that space with me.
So earlier when you were talking to us about within your onlyness, you talked about how when you enter a room, you change the power dynamics. So I was curious about what...
How do I change the power dynamics? I just did this the other day, and somebody actually wrote it up. So I was at an event called Thinkers 50, which is they literally rank every management thinker in the world, and there's this top 50 sort of group, which are, by the way, I'm number 22, number 6 most powerful woman management thinker. But it's really based on the power of their ideas, less about their charisma and influence in the world, but what's the power of their idea they're advocating, and what they're trying to do is be idea hunters for what will shape the future of management 20, 30 years out. And the first time I showed up there was 4 years ago, and I pretty much could guess based on the, you know, experience of other things that that room was going to be mostly white, mostly Harvard educated, as I would say it here, mostly male, and I knew that. So when I brought a table, I brought everyone that looked more like what I believe the future of management should and could be. So I included a person who used to be senior executive at Google, one of the most powerful Hispanic people in the world, and in fact has 4 degrees from Stanford University, is on the board of Stanford. And I went around and I basically built a table that looked like what I thought the world could and should be. And Financial Times actually wrote in their column that apparently management people can have fun because we saw it at this one table. And at first I remember reading that thinking, oh my God, I'm kind of embarrassed. A little embarrassed, you know, like, oh my God, we make so much noise and we had so much fun that everyone else was not having fun, but we were having fun. And then the next year, next time they were doing it, I sent an email out to about 100 people who are younger, kind of still coming up in the field of management, but I felt really had interesting ideas. And I said, why don't we all go to this conference together and basically hijack the conference and start showing them what the future of management could be by being there. And like 10 people took me up on that offer and said, sure, I'll come to London and blah, blah, blah. And so we started doing that. This year, what I did, so it's now, you know, third time in, I actually did this thing where I realized I knew about 20% of the audience, you know, the community, but they didn't know each other. So I actually would go up and say, hey, it's so great to see you. And then I would walk you over to somebody else that I thought you should know. And I was doing this pollination thing. I was very intentional about what I was doing. I knew exactly why I was there, because I thought if I could get this group more connected, they would actually end up building on each other's ideas. Right now, most people compete on ideas. And I thought if I could do that, that would be a culture hack in the group. And the guy who wrote it up said that I was a really good hugger because he noticed that I went and hugged a bunch of people, and then but he didn't actually notice what I was actually doing. He noticed the hugging part, which I found really kind of weird, but okay. But he noticed the sense of it. His sense of it, right, was that I came and made him feel welcome. That's why I asked the question about did you feel welcome. That first moment of somebody else welcoming you into a context can change the entire room. In most rooms, everyone's so nervous about their own, like, energy that they can't possibly be welcoming to anyone else, right, because they're anxious. A girlfriend wrote a book called Hiding in the Bathroom. Maura Ahrens Mealy, I think her last name is. By the way, for those of you that want to hide in the bathroom, this book is fantastic for handling that anxiety. But I do this culture hacking thing for each room. What is my goal in this room? What is my goal 5 years from now, 10 years from now in this room? So I can actually change the culture. So I do this kind of culture hacking thing on a regular basis. If I can get outside my own issues, because sometimes I have issues, my own issues too. But in this case, I was like, this is what I'm going to spend today doing. And I did that. So that could be an example. Be the change, right? It's the Gandhi quote. If you want the world to change, you actually have to embody the change. So a lot of what I spend time doing is living my onlyness, encouraging other people to live their onlyness and not see it as a brand thing. Right. The difference between brand and onlyness, by the way, brand is to position yourself in the marketplace like, am I better than you at X? Right? So that we can be competitive. Contributive work, onlyness is about what is it that's so in your inner truth that you live it? No one else can, by the way, do that. And the brighter it shines, of course other people will see it, and they can call it brand, but it is your onlyness, your truth manifest in the world. That's what you're going for. And the brighter that shines, the more other people can find you. And then the more you can join together to go make something happen. Any more on claim, or should we go on to community? Who wants to ask a question about community? Thank you so much.
So, I guess I came to the session thinking, you know, I have this idea and I want to make the organization listen to my idea. Sometimes, you know, you tell a story and then somebody else tells it, maybe sometimes a man, and it's their idea. And
maybe sometimes? Yeah. Lovely. So what a great question, right? So if you are trying to express your own individual ideas, but you often feel negated in the room, what can you do to change the room? Any of you, so my favorite example is one that the press covered right as Obama was leaving office, where a bunch of women who worked in the administration shared that they would actually agree ahead of time that if somebody else was wiping out their idea, they would actually be like, you know what Cheryl said over there, and you know what Alyssa said over there, let's kind of go back to that. And they had an intentional commitment to one another to make sure the idea wasn't lost just because a guy came along. And they just helped each other. And that wasn't like, that wasn't incestuous or anything, right? But if there's an idea that Alyssa has and Alyssa's idea wasn't heard, I can just pop it back up. And Alyssa can do the same for mine. And then we can build on each other's ideas so that the whole room changes. And by the way, if you only have to do that a few times, I've done this quite a bit, you only have to do that a few times where it starts to change the fundamental dynamics in the room and the men don't overtake the conversation, right? They're just used to it. They're just used to it. So you can just teach them a better and different way that will let ideas show up at the table. You're just helping them. And by the way, they need the help. So don't feel bad. Just, you know, like, that's your contributive piece. Do that piece and move on. And I'm not even mad at the person. I'm just like, yeah, whatever, I saw that. And then let's move on to the thing that will actually help us do better, be better, hear all the ideas at the table so we can actually have a shot at winning in the marketplace. I probably have one more minute. Anybody have another question? And then we'll bring it home. Yes, you wanna do the mic? Oh, we have one more over there. If you wanna grab that other mic, I'll still take the question.
I'll be very quick. So we talk about community and I really understand that this is kind of a women's conference, right? But what I really want to be, and I don't know the best way to do this in terms of community, is that men need to understand that they're being hurt by the way the system is in place as well. And I don't know if that message gets across quite as robustly as the we need to live our truths. How can we support the other, particularly men, particularly the ones that are going to be hurt, who have a tendency to be more systematically disadvantaged by the system? How can we create more community for those men as well? I mean, not only for us, but for the people that empower us.
It's a beautiful notion. So right now, most notions is, when we talk about diversity and inclusion, we're talking about diversity and inclusion as if it's about women or about people of color. By the way, diversity does not exist in a isolated vacuum. Diversity is all of us. And the minute we start looking at groups, what have we just done? Not noticed, not honored the individual that's sitting right there. So how I would do it is to actually notice, what does that person care about? Like, stop thinking about each of us by the group, which takes some retraining on our part, because we get seen as grouping all the time. But if we're gonna live in onlyness and we want this for ourselves, we actually have to see the other people and say, okay, what is that idea that person's lobbying for? We're gonna take this last question and I'm gonna do a wrap, because I'm gonna get some hook sign in a minute. All right.
So what I do for work is build community. It's a big, almost the whole part of what I do. But that those building of communities are primarily in-person, shared experience, pretty significant amount of time together, and I'm wondering what your ideas or suggestions would be for finding other ways to build that community that might utilize, you know, the internet or platforms where people don't necessarily have to show up and be physically present.
So in the book, I'll just point you to a story. There's a listserv story where 500 women are gathered together to actually change the ratio of women on boards and entrepreneurial settings, venture funding, and on the stage. And most of us don't meet each other in person for like years. In fact, last night we had a little list reunion of some of the speakers who are here. We figured out five of us were here, so we had drinks together last night. And most of us had never met each other in real life. So listservs around a common cause can be certainly a tool. But in chapter four and that story, I actually build out what are all the technology ways we can do it. So I'll point to that as a resource. I'm going to go do, I'm doing a panel this afternoon and I'm going to do a book signing for those of you that are interested in that. I would love to sign a book with you. I want to wrap with this. As we change who we are to one another, we can change our own power. By seeing ourselves, by seeing one another, and by connecting in meaning, this represents an opportunity to be transformed, ourselves and our communities, for us to be able to grow our capacity to contribute. Just because we've been negated in the past, we now have an opportunity to actually see one another and to start acting from that place of our truth as we go forward. So I want to thank you for your time, and I hope I get a chance to see you again.